going to look today and next week, and depending on how we do next week, maybe even the week following. This will either be a two or a three-part sermon, depending on what kind of progress we make. But we're going to be looking in the Bible first. The first thing we're going to look at are some timeless, eternal, constant truths. And then, after that, so we'll start with the general, timeless truths, biblical principles that are true and applicable in all times, in all places, to all generations, all locations. And after we start with the general, we'll go to the specific. We're going to look at a specific example focused on one man, one specific individual, whose life story illustrates the truthfulness of these principles we're going to look at first. We'll see all of these eternal or changeless truths played out because they're God's truths. We'll see God play them out in the life of one individual. It's one individual that maybe you've never heard of, or if you've heard of him, you may not recognize the name. I read that a long time ago. I'm not going to tell you the name of the individual we're going to focus on yet, not first of all. We'll spend most of today, if not all of today, looking at the principles, and then we'll see how they play out in this one individual's life in the Bible. Now, another thing that will be a little bit different about this sermon series is we're going to start out with the conclusions. We're going to get the punchline, the lessons of the whole story first, four of them, and then, as I say, later we will see how those apply in a particular instance. So we're going to look at four timeless truths. Number one is this. Even in horrible times, you can put other adjectives besides horrible, godless. Even in horrible, godless, ungodly times, evil times. Get the picture? Like today maybe, like 2018. Even in horrible, ungodly, frightening, chaotic times, even then, there will be, probably largely unknown, there will be silent heroes. There will be, even then, even in horrible, frightening, evil, chaotic, ungodly times, there will be largely unknown, silent heroes living in the shadows. Maybe many people don't know about them. Maybe most people don't know about them. There will be silent heroes who serve the true God. A remnant. That's a word that's used in the Bible to describe this phenomenon. There's always a remnant. It doesn't matter how awful things are, how ungodly they are. There is a true remnant who know and serve the true God. It's always the case. It's the case now in 2018. So it doesn't matter how frightening and evil and chaotic 2018 is, or how much worse 2019 will be. We need to believe, because we'll see it in the Bible, there will always be these silent heroes. Heroes, my term. I don't find that in the Bible, but a remnant. Serving the true God. A remnant who know and serve the true God. And the person we're going to focus on after we cover these general principles is one such individual. Maybe somebody that's really in the shadows. If I said the name right now, you know the old expression, always leave them wanting more. Don't give it all away at first. I'm not going to give you the name yet. In fact, I might not give you the name today. I got to the entire end of this part of the sermon, and I think for the first time in 10 years, I took a vote. I said, how many? I've got a handout here, worked up the handout, it's got the name all over it. I said, how many of you want to know right now who we've been talking about, and how many of you want to wait till next week? For the one time in 10 years, I was going to be guided by a vote. It came out tied. Half of them didn't want it, half of them did. So I decided to wait. I'm not going to give it to you today either, unless it slips out. I turned 70 years of age on this trip. I'm getting old. It might slip out, but probably not. Because I'm going to try not to let it slip. I'm going to let you wait. I might give a reward. You've got all week. I'm going to describe him in every way except giving his name, and I'm going to give you a week. The person or persons who can come to services next week and tell me this person's name, I'll probably give them a reward, I'll give them an attaboy or an attagirl, maybe two. Or if Bobby Gibson gives me any more candy, I'll give you one of his chocolates. I got a big thing of chocolates today, so. All right, I always give it away to the kids if I can. But some of you are 80-year-old kids, so. All right, so here we go. Even in horrible, frightening, evil, chaotic times, ungodly times, there will be, largely unknown to most of the world, in the shadows, perhaps, probably in the shadows, some silent heroes who serve the true God. This is a remnant. Now, we're going to look at some scriptures that leave no doubt about that being the truth, that being the case. That's a universal principle, a timeless principle. Now, let's start in the book of 1 Kings with somebody whose name you do know. Even good people sometimes lose track of this first timeless truth. Even good people, righteous people, sometimes need a reminder that this is true. And that was the case here. This is 1 Kings chapter 19. And the person here, he's not the hero of this story, he's not the focal, but this is of this point. Elijah. Everybody knows the name Elijah. You think, oh, a great prophet of God. Yes, he was. He was a great prophet of God. He typed John the Baptist, one who would come preparing the way. There will be an end time Elijah. This is a major figure in the Bible. But even this righteous man needed to be reminded of this first principle. We'll see that here. All right, we go to 1 Kings 19. We start in verse 1. Ahab, well, that's another name we're probably familiar with, Ahab. Hardly anything good associated with the word Ahab. When you think of that, you think not good. Very unrighteous man. And even worse is his wife Jezebel. And here are the first words of chapter 19 is Ahab talking to Jezebel. What's he talking to her about? What Elijah just did. Got all their pagan prophets and false prophets killed. This was a great moment in Elijah's life. God had used him to witness to the entire nation of Israel. And it was a showdown between all the prophets of Baal and false gods against the one man, Elijah. And who won? Well, God did, of course. Elijah did, of course. And it was a rout. The false prophets were routed. And right on the heels of this, Ahab goes back and tells Jezebel. Ahab was wicked. Jezebel was just plain mean. She was a fierce, mean, pagan queen. She wasn't even, that rhymed, didn't it? I didn't do that on purpose. It just came out that way. She was one awful person. I think she totally intimidated everybody around her, including Ahab, her husband. Ahab told Jezebel all that Elijah had done, also how he had executed all the prophets with the sword. At this point, Jezebel takes over in this story. She takes over completely. Jezebel sent a messenger to Elijah, and the paraphrase is, you got 24 hours to live. You have 24 hours to live. I'm going to see that you die. Jezebel sent a messenger to Elijah saying, so let the gods do to me. What do you mean gods? There's one God. Well, she worshipped many gods. She introduced Baal worship, along with all the other calf worship that was already there. So let the gods do to me. And more also, if I do not make your life as the life of one of them, these prophets you just had killed, false prophets you just had killed, by tomorrow about this time, you got 24 hours to live. She's a ferocious, frightening, evil woman. And this great man of God, this great prophet of God, who had just been used by God to witness about the truth of the true God, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and Abraham, and David, Moses, ran for his life. He was so scared. Seems almost hard to believe. When he saw that, when he heard that from Jezebel, he arose and ran for his life. How far did he run? You might want to check this out on your own time. All this action, Elijah the prophet's Baal, took place way up in the north, Mount Carmel. Way up in the north. How far did he run? He ran through the entire country. He ran almost to the southern end of the country. all the way down to Beersheba. That's over 100 miles. It sounds like he's on foot. He got out of there and he did not look back. He wants to get as far away from Jezebel as he can. He's completely terrorized by her threat. This great prophet of God. Beersheba is about 100 miles south of Mount Carmel. And he only stops there temporarily. And then he ran another 250 miles to get to Mount Sinai. Let's keep reading. When he saw that he ran for his life, he went to Beersheba, which belongs to Judah, southernmost tip, 100 miles from where he had been, where Jezebel was, and he left his servant there. So apparently he has one person with him, his servant, his loyal servant. But Jezebel is a dominant personality. She has agents all throughout the country. She had introduced Baal worship all throughout the country. You can see the wheels turning. She might have agents anywhere I go. In fact, they may capture my manservant, my servant here, and make him talk. So he leaves even his servant. Now he's completely by himself. And where does he go? Let's read it. Verse 4, he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness and came and sat down under a broom tree, and he prayed that he might die. He's so discouraged, so intimidated, he wants to die. God encourages him, said, don't give up. He said, it's enough. God, I've done all I can do. I'm the last one left. There's nobody left. Nobody I know about's left. I'm it. Take my life, for I'm no better than my father's. Then as he lay and slept under a broom tree, suddenly an angel touched him and said to him, rise and eat. Tried to encourage, gently encourage. Not a lot of correction here, at least not yet. Trying to encourage Elijah. You need something to eat. You're exhausted. You're hungry. He looked, and there by his head was a cake baked on coals and a jar of water. So he ate and drank and lay down again. And the angel of the Lord came back the second time and touched him and said, rise and eat, because the journey is too great for you. So he arose and he ate, he drank, and he went in the strength of that food 40 days. Now he starts a 40-day fast on foot, still running away from Jezebel. And how far does he go? 40 days and 40 nights, no food, no water, on foot, by himself, to Horeb, or Sinai, the mountain of God. That's another 250 miles, roughly, from here. So he's 350 miles running away from Jezebel. He's exhausted, 40-day fast, hasn't eaten in 40 days. Pretty rough shape. Now, he's forgotten a basic lesson. It's lesson number one. It's truth number one. Even in horrible and ungodly times, there will still be, largely unknown to most people, a silent heroes living and working in the shadows who are still serving the true God, a remnant. He's got to learn this lesson, maybe relearn it. So we come to verse 9. He's at Mount Sinai. He's down in Egypt, Sinai Peninsula. He's not even in Judah or Israel. There he went into a cave. You talk about being alone. 40-day fast, nobody around, very discouraged, very alone, wanting to die. He went into a cave and spent the night in that place. And behold, the word of the Eternal came to him and said, Elijah, what are you doing here? What are you doing here? Oh, God, of course, knew. He knew the state of mind, the motivation that took Elijah there. But he's being as gentle as he can. What are you doing here in this cave? 350. My work that I'm doing for you isn't done yet. You left some unfinished business up there. God's about to tell him three specific things he still needs to do way back there. He's going to have to retrace all his steps. What are you doing here, Elijah? Oh, Elijah's got his answer. I have been very zealous for the Eternal God of hosts. He's speaking to the Eternal God of hosts, or his angel. For the children of Israel have forsaken your covenant, torn down your altars, killed. I've preached. You've done miracles through me, and hadn't done a bit of good. Nobody's repented. Hadn't done a bit of good. Torn down your altars, killed your prophets with the sword. I alone am left. I'm the last one. Truth number one, even Elijah had forgotten, even in horrible, frightening, evil, chaotic, ungodly times, there will be, largely unknown, silent heroes working in the shadows, living in the shadows, who serve the true God, who haven't given up. No, actually, Elijah, you're not alone. And that's the point he needs to hear about. I alone am left. So God, or the angel of God, he said, go out and stand on the mountain before the Lord. That's verse 11. You got to know where to look. You won't find something unless you know where to look for it. If you're looking in the wrong place, you won't find it. And that's the lesson of the next few verses. If you're looking for evidence of where God is, you've got to know where to look. You've got to know what to look for. He says, go out and stand on the mountain before the Eternal. And behold, the Eternal passed by, and a great and strong wind tore into the mountains. This is a big show. A lot of sound, a lot of fury, a lot of things you can hear with your ears, you can see with your eyes. And what's the lesson? That's not where God's working. A lot of times what you can see with your eyes and hear with your ears and feel being pressed up against the mountainside by this fierce wind, if that's where you're looking for God, often you'll be wrong in things that are easily noted, easily seen, easily heard. Behold, the Lord passed by, and a great and strong wind tore into the mountains. Now, God was in that, but that's not what was important, what God was doing. This was just manifestations of nature. Yes, God caused the wind, but in another sense, he wasn't in that. That wasn't where he was doing important work. That's not where the important thing was. That's what it says here. But the Eternal was not in the wind. He caused the wind, but he wasn't in it. That's not what you're looking for, Elijah. Things you can see with your eyes or hear with your ears or feel with your body. And afterwards, the wind of an earthquake. But the Lord was not in the earthquake. He caused it, but he wasn't in it. Verse 12, and after the earthquake, a fire, but the Eternal was not in the fire. Things you can feel, see, hear, experience with your five senses. That's not what you're really looking for, Elijah, if you're looking where God's working. And after the fire, a still, small voice. So faint you couldn't maybe even really hear it with your ears, but you can perceive it with your mind through the Spirit of God. That's what you should be looking for, Elijah. If you haven't been looking there, you haven't found what you're looking for, so you feel like you're all alone. You're the last one left. So at the end of verse 12, we know the lesson God is trying to get across to Elijah, but has Elijah, a great man of God, learned it yet? Well, let's keep reading. Has he learned it yet? Verse 13, so it was when Elijah heard it that he wrapped his face in his mantle and he went out and stood at the entrance of the cave. Suddenly a voice came to him and said, what are you doing here, Elijah? This sounds like a broken record. It sounds like we're going to have to go through the whole thing again. Apparently we are. What are you doing here, Elijah? Didn't we just go through this? Yes, but you didn't get the lesson. You didn't really perceive what I'm trying to tell you. So he said, I've been very zealous for the Eternal. Doesn't this sound like exactly what he said earlier? I have been very zealous for the Eternal God of hosts, because the children of Israel have forsaken your covenant, torn down your altars, killed your prophets with the sword. I alone am left. I'm the last one. Nobody else. Nobody else is clinging to the true God. And they seek to take my life, especially Jezebel and her agents. Then the Eternal said, you know, we ought to get a letter from this guy back here. Am I supposed to be mowing the lawn on the Sabbath, right when you're giving a sermon? No. Mr. Moranville would say, no. Could you wait another time? But I can stand it if you can. All right. Then the Eternal said to him, go, return on your way. I want you to retrace all your steps. How many steps was that? 350 miles. There's unfinished business for you back there. Yeah, back there where Jezebel is. Trust me, I know what I'm doing, God is saying. I know how to deal with Jezebel. I know how to deal with Jezebel. Go return on your way to the wilderness of Damascus. He has three specific jobs he wants him to do. And sometimes when we see what God has his servants do, it kind of makes us scratch our head. The first task is to go back and anoint a pagan from another nation to be that nation's king. I thought Elijah was a prophet to Israel. He is. But, oh yes, I have a job for you, God said. I want you to go find a man named Hazael, and I want you to anoint him king over Syria. Here's a Syrian, a pagan Syrian, and God says, Elijah, you, my prophet, one, you left some unfinished business. You got to go find this man and anoint him and make him king over Syria, a traditional enemy of Israel. Who saw that coming? That's number one. Number two, verse 16. And, secondly, I want you to find another man named Jehu. Now, when we get into the specific story next week, that'll be another name that you'll run across. Jehu. Jehu is God's assassin. There's some killing that needs to be done, according to God, and Jehu's the man to do it. So this is God's assassin. And so God wants Elijah to go find Jehu, anoint him as the new king in Israel. Wait a minute, I thought Israel already had a king. That's right, until Jehu kills him at God's behest. So go back, retrace your 350-mile flight, find Jehu, make him the new king of Israel so he can kill people. This isn't what we often would expect. The problem with some people is they think that they're Jehu. You better be real sure you're Jehu before you go start killing people in the name of God, because otherwise you shouldn't do it. But Jehu was chosen by God to do some killing of people who needed killing. All right, in God's view. And then thirdly, he says, I want you to go back and anoint another person. I want you to find and ordain your replacement. You have been my prophet. When your time has come to an end, and that shortly, I want you to find and ordain and anoint your replacement, Elisha. Sounds just like Elijah. So he says, do that. Elisha, the son of Shaphat of Abel-Mehola, you shall anoint as prophet in your place. So there's unfinished business, Elijah. What are you doing in this cave in Sinai? It shall be that whoever escapes the sword of Hazael, Jehu will kill, and whoever escapes from the sword of Jehu, Elisha will kill. There's some killing that needs to take place. And verse 18 is the punchline. It's this first eternal truth. Elijah had forgotten it. If he ever knew it, he needs to be reminded of it. Yes, I have reserved 7,000 in Israel. You're not the only one. You said twice you're the only one. You're not. I have 7,000. They're in the shadows. You don't even know them. You're my prophet. You don't even know who they are. But I do. I have reserved 7,000 in Israel, all whose knees are not bowed to Baal, and every mouth that has not kissed him. So Elijah has to learn this lesson. Let's go to the New Testament. This is an eternal truth, a timeless principle. It's always true. It's always been true since there's been mankind on the earth. That even in horrible, ungodly, frightening, evil, and chaotic times, there would largely, unknown to the world, be silent heroes living and working in the shadows, serving the true God, a remnant who know and serve the true God. Let's go to Romans chapter 9 in the New Testament. And we'll look at verse 6. Romans 9 and verse 6. Now, verse 6 looks like it is a ready-made answer to Elijah, who says, I'm the only one left. Woe is me. It is not that the word of God has taken no effect, for they're not all Israel who are of Israel. What does that mean? You have to know what to look for in order to find it. You got to know what you're looking for if you're going to find it. I'm looking for Israelites, people who serve the God of Israel. You got to know where to look. Don't just look at the shape of their nose. Or don't just look at the DNA in their blood. Those are physical Israelites. Sometimes God has spiritual Israelites. They may not have Israelite blood, but they got an Israelite mind. And they're faithful to the true God. There's physical Israelites and spiritual Israelites. And if you're only looking for at physical Israelites, you might not find anybody that's obeying the true God, but you might have to find some spiritual Israelites. Elijah, you might not know where to look to find those who had not bowed a knee to Baal. They're living in the shadows. You don't know who they are, but I do. That's the point. It is not that the word of God has taken no effect, for they're not all Israel who are of Israel, nor are they all children because they're the seed of Abraham. But it's in Isaac your seed will be called. So you go back to the days of Abraham and his wife Sarah and his handmaiden Hagar. And you're looking and you're looking and you're looking at somebody who has Abraham's DNA in their blood. And you're trying to find, I'm trying to find somebody that God is working through. Well, if you're looking at the descendants of Hagar and Ishmael, you're not going to find it because it's in Isaac that your seed will be called. God had rejected the promised seed line was Isaac, not Ishmael. Sarah, not Hagar. You got to know where to look to find what you want. And the point continues on. That is, those who are the children of the flesh, these are not the children of God. Ishmael was born the way every other baby's been born, because a man and a woman come together and share their DNA. That's the way all babies are born. But that's not the way the promised seed. Abraham and Sarah came together when she couldn't have a baby unless God did a miracle, and then she did. The impossible baby, Isaac. You got to know where to look. You got to look where miracles happen. If you're finding what God is doing, sometimes they're silent miracles. Sometimes the miracles are in the shadow. But you got to know where to look to find out what you're looking for. So verse 9, this is the word of promise. At this time I will come and Sarah will have a son, not Hagar. If you're looking at the millions and millions that came from Hagar and then Ishmael, you're not going to find what you're looking for. And then verse 10, the point goes to another generation. Not only this, but when Rebekah also had conceived by one man, even by our father Isaac, the children not yet being born, nor having done any good or evil, that the purpose of God, according to election, might stand, not of works, but of him who calls, it was said, the older will serve the younger. Jacob I've loved, Esau I've hated. The next generation, you have twin boys. Well, God always works through the firstborn, right? Usually, unless God doesn't. So that's always the correct answer, unless it's the wrong answer. In this case, it's the second son. It's the second son, the second twin. It's Jacob, it's not Esau. If you want to see where God's working, you're looking at all the descendants of Esau. You're not going to find it, for the most part. You've got to look for Jacob. So now we also go to chapter 11 of Romans. Let's look at verse 2. This is what Elijah thought. He was so discouraged. I'm the last one left. The whole project has failed. Then they're going to kill me and there won't be anybody who serves the true God. That's what he was thinking. God says this in reply, verse 2. But he says it in all times, not just to Elijah. God has not cast away his people whom he foreknew. The project hasn't failed. It's not over. There's nobody. It's not that there's a null set, an empty set. It's not the case that there's nobody left who knows and serves the true God. Do you not know what the scripture says of Elijah? How he pleads with God, this is what we read earlier, against Israel, saying, Lord, they've killed your prophets and torn down your altars, and I alone am left. No, you're not. You just don't know where to look. And they seek my life now, and then there won't be anybody. What does the divine response say to him? I've reserved for myself 7,000, Elijah. You're not the last one. You're not the only one. That's as true in 2018 as it was in 1000 B.C., Let's go to the book of Ecclesiastes. Working in the shadows. If you want to find out where God's doing something, sometimes you have to look the last place that anybody would expect. This is a similar story here. Book of Ecclesiastes. He makes the point with a parable, whether this actually happened or not, I don't know. Perhaps it did. We're not given a lot of the details, we're given the principle. It's the same principle we've been looking at. Here's an ancient town. It's surrounded by a massive enemy army. The town's goose is cooked. It doesn't have a chance. It doesn't have a chance against this powerful army that's surrounding it. Or does it? You know, Yehudi, the garbage collector. Nobody gives him any attention. Nobody knows anything about him. He's just a little guy. Nobody knows anything about him. He saved the town. He saved the town. Nobody else. They called an emergency session of the town council. What are we going to do? The enemy's army's around us. When they ran out of answers, had no answers, this little nobody saved the town. Ecclesiastes 9, verse 4. That's not right. 14. Ecclesiastes 9, verse 14. There was a little city, very few men in it. A great king came against it, besieged it, built great snares around it. Their goose is cooked. They're all going to die. Where are they? Now there was found in it, in the shadows, up until now, nobody paid him any attention, a poor wise man. His godly wisdom, apparently. Nobody else did. And he, by his wisdom, delivered the city. It must not be important to know the details, if this was a true story. It's the lesson, not the details. Doesn't tell us how he saved it, but he did it with wisdom. Yet no one remembered that same poor man. Somehow he saved the town from the army. The army goes away, and now he's Yehudi, the unknown garbage collector again. Nobody pays him any mind. Now all the town council members start congratulating themselves that they are the ones who saved the city. They did nothing. So we revise history, and we ignore the one who saved the town. That's the way it works. So that's lesson number one. Those are some biblical passages that underscore that. You got to know where to look. But in the shadows, you're going to find where God's still working. Anytime, any place in history. All right, timeless truth number two. Come out of her, my people. That's timeless truth number two. God's people are to be separate from the evil of this world. They're not to make unholy alliances with the evil of this world. It's come out of her, my people. Unholy alliances between good and evil don't produce good results. Unholy alliances between good and evil do not produce good results in the long run. In the short run, they sometimes appear to. And that's why people are seduced into going into unholy alliances. They can see the short-term benefit. But the Word of God is very clear. We should not enter into unholy alliances with evil, even though there might be a short-term benefit, because in the long term, God's judgment is very harsh on that. He doesn't want his people entering into unholy alliances with evil, even though human reason says we should. Let's look at some scriptures that make this point very clear. Come out of her, my people. Unholy alliances between good and evil do not work. We're going to see this played out. We're going to see this played out next week and maybe the week after when we get into the specific case. Oh, this will be very obvious. But let's look at some scriptures that lead us to this conclusion. Proverbs, a real easy one to start with. Proverbs chapter 1, verse 10. Very simple, hard to misunderstand. My son, if sinners entice you, don't consent. Don't join in with them. If they say, come with us, let us lie and wait to shed blood. Yeah, we can kill this guy, we can get all his money, we'll share it among ourselves. In the short run, there seems to be a benefit. Don't do it. Don't do it. Don't be enticed to enter into unholy agreements, partnerships, alliances with evil. Let's look at chapter 13 of the same book. Proverbs 13, verse 20. The reason unholy alliances are to be avoided is because the evil will pull the good down. The good will not pull the evil up. The evil will pull the good down. That's the way it works. So don't be connected to evil or it will pull you down, even if you're good. This is Proverbs 13 and verse 20. He who walks with wise men will be wise, but the companion of fools will be destroyed. Fools are those who do not fear and serve the true God. They're evil. And if we are in companionship with them, close alliances with them, it will lead to destruction. Maybe not in the short run. That's why it's so seductive. But in the long run, it will. Inevitably. Let's look at Revelation. And this is throughout the Bible. All times, all places, to all people. This is a timeless truth. Revelation 18. This is the very familiar language that I summarized this point as being. Come out of her, my people. God is always telling this to his people. Her is Babylon. Her is the sinful ways of this world, the institutions and the ways and the beliefs of this world. All right, so Revelation 18 and verse 4. I heard another voice from heaven saying, come out of her, my people, lest you share in her sins, and lest you receive of her plagues. Unholy alliances are to be avoided. 2 Corinthians chapter 6. Let's start in verse 14. Different words, same point. Do not be, verse 14, 2 Corinthians 6, 14. Do not be unequally yoked together with unbelievers. For what fellowship has righteousness with lawlessness? And what communion has light with darkness? And what accord has Christ with Belial? What part has a believer with an unbeliever? So this has so many applications. It's so often that human reasoning leads us to believe this doesn't apply. But it does apply. This is godly reasoning. What part does a believer have with an unbeliever? And what agreement has the temple of God with idols? For you are the temple of the living God. And God doesn't want idols in his temple. As God has said, I will dwell in them and walk with among them and be their God, and they shall be my people. Therefore, come out from among them and be separate, says the Lord. Do not touch what is unclean, and I will receive you, and I will be a father to you, and you shall be my sons and daughters, says the Lord Almighty. All right, now let's go to a case in point. Just like in the first case, a great man of God. I fully expect to see Elijah in the first resurrection. No question in my mind. But he needed to relearn or learn point one, because he'd forgotten it. He lost sight of it. So even very good people, righteous people, need to be reminded of these things. Here's going to be a case. We're going to trace this through two generations where good people lost sight of this second point, and they needed to be reminded of it. And then it's recorded for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the world are come. So let's go to 2 Chronicles. We'll begin in chapter 14. This is probably a name that you remember. Asa. Asa was a righteous king. The overall evaluation of Asa before God is very positive. We'll read some of that. But even Asa did some compromising with regard to this second point, and it did not produce good. And then we'll see it went on to the next generation, and they did some compromising. And it didn't turn out very well at all. And we see God's judgment. At the end of this two-generational look, we'll see that this point remains true. Unholy alliances between good and evil do not work. In the long run, they do not produce good results, and God does not want to see his people engage in them. All right, so 2 Corinthians 14, the story of Asa. We begin in verse 1. This is Asa's father about to die, and Asa's about to become the king. So Abijah, 2 Chronicles 14 and verse 1. Abijah rested with his fathers. He died. They buried him in the city of David. Then Asa, his son, reigned in his place. In his days, the land was quiet for 10 years. Starts off pretty well. Verse 2. Asa did what was good and right in the eyes of the Eternal is God. Very good. How would you like that to be said about you and written in the Bible? That's good. He removed the altar. He did a lot of good things. He went to war against idolatry. He removed the altars of the foreign gods and the high places, and he broke down the sacred pillars. He cut down the wooden images. That's all very good. Verse 4, he commanded Judah. He just didn't do this privately. He said, this is the law. We're going to get back to the worship of the true God. He commanded Judah to seek the eternal God of their fathers and to observe the law and the commandment. A lot of good. Now, in many cases, these kings of Israel and Judah, you find part of their story in Chronicles, and you find part of their story in Kings. So let's keep looking at the life of Asa. So far, everything we've read is very good. A very righteous man, a very righteous king. Let's go to 1 Kings now and get more of the story. Some of it will sound familiar, what we just read. Let's go to 1 Kings chapter 15. And we'll start in verse 8. It starts off just the way we read it in Chronicles. This is 1 Kings 15 and verse 8. So Abijah rested with his fathers. They buried him in the city of David, and Asa his son reigned in his place. In the 20th year of Jeroboam, the king of Israel, Asa became king over Judah. So this is a marker. When God's talking about a king down in Judah, he'll often tell us how long the guy up in Israel had been reigning when this one in Judah began. Somebody up in Israel named Samaria named Jeroboam had been there for 20 years when Asa starts. Just a time marker. The 20th year of Jeroboam, the king of Israel, Asa became king over Judah. He reigned 41 years. That's a long reign. He was king for a long time. He's in Jerusalem, down where the temple is. His grandmother's name was Maaka. You might say, well, why is that relevant? Well, it'll become obvious. That's his grandmother's name, Maaka, the granddaughter of Abishalom, Shalom. Asa did what was right in the eyes of the Eternal, as did his father David. So his role model, great, 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 great father David, a man after God's own heart. Imperfect, to be sure, but still a righteous man who'll be in the kingdom of God. Asa made David his ancestor, his role model. He did a lot of good. He banished, verse 12, the perverted persons from the land. Homosexuality being rampant in a land, in a culture, in an era is not a new thing. It was rampant back then. He had the power. He got rid of them. He either ran them out of the country or killed them. He banished the perverted persons from the land, removed all the idols that his fathers had made. So he didn't do it like daddy or granddaddy. He did it like great, 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 great granddaddy David. That's who he chose to pattern his life after. Also, he removed Maaka, his grandmother. Well, you can't do that. You can't get rid of grandma. What if grandma is a pagan? What if grandma is evil? That's what Asa did. He removed Maaka, his grandmother, from being queen mother. I'm not sure he killed her, but he certainly took away all her honors and all her authority. I guess we could read it either way. He removed her from being queen mother. Why? Because she had made an obscene image of Asherah. She was a pagan. She was an idolater. Asa cut down her obscene image and burned it by the brook Kidron, but the high places were not removed. Now that's the only negative mark we've seen so far. He didn't go all the way in removing these alternative worship places. He got rid of a lot of them, but not all of them. Where are sacrifices supposed to be made? They're supposed to be made one place, in the temple in Jerusalem. People were making them elsewhere. Maybe some of them to the true God, but they shouldn't have been, and probably a lot of them to false gods, which they definitely should not have been. He compromised a little bit. He didn't go all the way. He's not perfect. The high places were not removed. Nevertheless, Asa's heart was loyal to the Eternal all his days. And overall, a very good evaluation. You'd like that to be said about you and recorded in the Bible. So let's see how much of this passage I want to read. All right. Keep reading a few more verses. He also brought into the house of the Eternal the things which his father had dedicated. So he's trying to renovate the temple and reestablish the worship of the true God in the temple. That's good. And the things which he himself had dedicated, silver and gold and utensils. But now, verse 16, wish it wasn't there. Wish 16, 17, wish they weren't there, but they are. We're to learn from this. Good marks, good marks, good marks. One tiny bad mark, good marks, good marks. Overall, a student, a righteous king. But it says there in verse 16, there was a war between Asa and Baasha, the king of Israel, all their days. So here we have righteous Asa down in the south in Judah. We have unrighteous king Baasha, the king of the 10 tribes, Samaria, Israel, up in the north. Continual battle. Baasha is an evil man. Verse 17, and Baasha, the king of Israel, came up against Judah. So he's going to attack Asa and his armies. Evil attacking righteous. And he built Ramah, that he might let none go out or come into Asa, the king of Judah. He basically built a fort that was going to choke off, a choke point, so Judah would be choked out. Their army, commerce. So what does Asa do? Well, clearly he trusts in God to deliver him from his evil twin up there, Baasha, not a twin, but the king in Samaria. No, he doesn't. He doesn't trust God. He does some compromising. He doesn't keep in mind point two. Come out of her, my people. Unholy alliances between good and evil do not work in the long run, even though they appear to in the short run, and God will not be pleased with them. He forgot that point. So what does he do when he's threatened by the evil king of Israel? He enters into an unholy alliance with the evil king of Syria. He goes to the neighboring nation. He tries to buy their army. Let's read it. Verse 18. Asa took all the silver and gold that was left in the treasuries of the house of the Lord. Whose money is that? That was money dedicated to God, to repairing the temple. Asa, keep your hands off that money. That's not your money. He takes that money. He doesn't keep his hands off that money. And he goes out and buys an alliance with Syria to protect him from Israel. He took all the silver and the gold that was left in the treasuries of the house of the Eternal and the treasuries of the king's house, and he delivered them into the hand of his servants. And King Asa sent them to Ben-Hadad, the son of Tebermon, the son of Hezion, the king of Syria, who dwelt in Damascus, saying, let there be a treaty, an alliance. Here's money. Send your soldiers down here and bail me out. Let there be a treaty between you and me, as there was between my father and your father. See, I have sent you a present of silver and gold. Yeah, silver and gold dedicated to God's temple. Come and break your treaty with Baasha, the king of Israel, so that he will withdraw from me. Come bail me out. Asa, could God have bailed you out? So Ben-Hadad heeded King Asa and sent the captains of his armies against the cities of Israel. He attacked Ejon, Dan, Ebal-Beth-Makkah or something, and all these other places. Now, in the short run, this certainly seems to have been a good result. In the short run. That's why, again, it's so seductive to do this at times. It happened when Baasha heard of it that he stopped building Ramah and remained in Tirzah. Threat removed. Well, I guess God's just going to wink at this. He had told us not to do it, but we did it, and it seemed to work out. Maybe we'll do it again. Let's continue on the story. Verse 24. So now Asa dies. That's pretty much the story of Asa. Pretty good marks. One little hiccup along the way, and then this, which appears to be a pretty major hiccup. Avoiding timeless truth number two. Pretending it doesn't really apply to him. So verse 24 says, Asa rested with his father. Now he dies and was buried with his fathers in the city of David, his father. Then Jehoshaphat, his son, reigned in his place. And what do we think about when we hear the name Jehoshaphat? Pretty good. Another righteous king. But what's his role model? In some sense, David, but in another sense, Asa, his righteous father, his overall righteous father. So I'm sure he learned good things from Asa, but did he also learn a bad one in violation of this second timeless truth? Let's continue reading the story. Let's go to chapter 22, 1 Kings 22, pick it up in verse 41. So this is something about Jehoshaphat. Like father, like son? Well, let's see. Jehoshaphat, this is chapter 22, verse 41, 1 Kings. Jehoshaphat, the son of Asa, had become king over Judah in the fourth year of Ahab, the king of Israel. Jehoshaphat was 35 years old when he became king, and he reigned 25 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Azubah, the daughter of Shilhai. And he walked in all the ways of his father Asa. Yeah, like father, like son. And most of those like father ways are good ways. But one or two of them aren't. He did not turn aside from them, doing what was right in the eyes of the Eternal. That's good, overall good. Nevertheless, the high places were not taken away. The same small hiccup or compromise didn't go all the way in removing the false places of worship. It's like Asa had not gone all the way. Yeah, like father, like son. Good and bad. Nevertheless, the high places were not taken away, for the people offered sacrifices and burned incense on the high places. There was one place that was to be done, and that was at the temple. Oh, God will understand. It's too far. God understands what God understands. God understands what God commands. He does it for a reason. And then look at verse 44. Jehoshaphat made peace with the king of Israel. Who's the king of Israel? Wicked Ahab. We just read that. One of the worst kings that ever lived, one of the most unrighteous kings, certainly married to one of the most unrighteous women, unrighteous, fierce, God-defying queens that they ever had up north. And he's going to enter into a negotiation or an alliance, an unholy alliance with Israel. There's some irony here. What did his daddy do? What did Asa do? Asa entered into an unholy alliance with Syria to protect Asa from Israel. What are we going to see now that Jehoshaphat does? He he turns it around just a little bit. He enters into an unholy alliance with Israel to protect himself against Syria. Same song, second verse. Slightly different words. It's the same mistake. He enters into an unholy alliance with wicked Ahab. So verse 44 there, he made peace with the king of Israel. Let's get the details there. Let's go to 2 Chronicles chapter 18. What is this alliance? What is this peace with Israel that I'm saying he shouldn't have done, just like his father shouldn't have done what he did? All right, we go to 2 Chronicles chapter 18, and we begin in verse 1. This is again about Jehoshaphat, Asa's son. Jehoshaphat had riches and honor in abundance. And by marriage, he allied himself with Ahab. Big problem. What do you mean by marriage? He caused his son, that is, Jehoshaphat caused his son to marry a daughter of Ahab. So the southern kingdom of Judah and the northern kingdom of Israel went into an alliance through marriage of each of the king's children. Jehoshaphat's son, Ahab's daughter. An unholy alliance. Is this going to produce good results? Is God going to be pleased with this? Well, I think you already know the answer, but let's read it in the Bible. After some years, this is verse 2 of chapter 18 of 2 Chronicles. After some years, he went down to visit Ahab in Samaria, this wicked king that he had entered into an unholy alliance with through marriage of their children. And Ahab killed sheep and oxen in abundance for him. And the people who were with him persuaded him to go up with him to Ramoth-Gilead. In the short run, this seems to have been producing good results. There's peace now between Judah and Israel. Everything's good. Ahab's playing nice with us. If we're Jehoshaphat, Ahab's playing nice with us. And now Ahab proposes a joint war between him and now his buddy Jehoshaphat against Syria. Ahab, king of Israel, said to Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, verse 3, "Will you go with me against Ramoth-Gilead, against the Syrians?" And he answered him, "I am as you are." You shouldn't have said that. You shouldn't have been entwined in this unholy alliance in the first place, and you shouldn't go to war with him. "I'm as you are. We're buddies. We're in this contract. We're in this alliance. I'm your ally. I am as you are, my people as your people." Physically, they were. They all had Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob's DNA. "We will be with you in the war." Skip over to chapter 19, verse 1. "Then Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, returned safely to his house in Jerusalem." Well, there you have it. Entering into this alliance with Ahab produced good results in the short term. We whooped the Syrians. Jehoshaphat gets to go home in peace. I guess that principle doesn't apply. Well, let's keep reading. "Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, returned safely to his house in Jerusalem. And Jehu," remember him, God's assassin. This was the man who was told by Elijah, "You're going to be the new king, and I want you to kill some people." "Jehu, the son of Hanani, the seer, went out to meet him." Uh-oh, is he going to kill Jehoshaphat? No, but he's going to deliver him some killing words from God. Righteous King Jehoshaphat. "Jehu, the son of Hanani," he's the king up north, or he's going to be when he kills Ahab, "went out to meet him, and he said to King Jehoshaphat, 'Should you help the wicked and love those who hate the eternal? Should you have entered into this contract with Ahab?'" I'm going to kill Ahab at God's behest. "Should you have done that? You're a righteous man. What business do you have entering into an alliance with Ahab? Should you help the wicked and love those who hate the eternal? Therefore, the wrath of the eternal is upon you." Righteous King Jehoshaphat. Lost sight of this point. "Come out of her, my people. Don't enter into unholy alliances with evil. They won't work. They won't work in the long term. They won't please God." And now this assassin has to be the one who tells Jehoshaphat, "You should not have done that. You should have trusted God." Does that mean Jehoshaphat is condemned to the lake of fire? No. Overall, good life. I mean, I can't be for certain. I expect he'll be in the first resurrection. He's one of the few righteous kings. But even good people make mistakes, and these things are recorded in the Bible so that we don't repeat them. Verse 3, nevertheless, good things are found in you. That's the overall record of his life. But you made a mistake here, in that you have removed the wooden images from the land and have prepared your heart to seek God. Sometimes we can learn the easy way by learning the lessons of mistakes even made by good people. Timeless truth number 3. Yes, it's true, blood is thicker than water. We know that part of it. That's part of conventional wisdom. We take care of our relatives. We make allowances for blood relatives that we wouldn't for anybody else. Yes, it's true that blood is thicker than water, but you know that thick blood, sometimes that turns out to be a gooey, deadly, incorrect basis for decisions. Yeah, blood is thicker than water, but sometimes it's a gooey, deadly, incorrect basis for decisions. Well, I'm related to him. Well, we just saw what Jehoshaphat did, even with his grandmother, because she was evil. So that kind of leads into this point. This is a timeless truth. Blood is thicker than water, true, but sometimes it's a gooey, deadly, and incorrect basis for decisions. Matthew 10. Got to have the right kind of blood. Got to have the right kind of relative. Matthew 10 and verse 37. This is something Jesus said. He who loves father or mother, well, they've got my DNA. I have their DNA. They're blood relatives. I can't ever oppose them, disappoint them, go contrary to what they tell me to do. He says, if you love your father or your mother more than you love me, you're not worthy of me. You've got to make a decision, Jesus tells his disciples, in all times. He who loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. That's a timeless truth. Luke 14. Closest blood relatives, father, mother, son, daughter. There might be times when you got to go against that relationship to serve God, to serve Christ. That's what Christ just said. Luke 14, verse 26. He says, if anyone comes to me and does not hate, love less, his father, mother, wife, children, brothers, sisters, all blood relatives, close ones. Yes, in his own life, he cannot be my disciple. Mark 3. We know these things, but this is this third timeless point, and we're going to see it played out very vividly next week in the life of a particular individual. This is Mark 3, verse 35. Whoever does the will of God, that's my brother and my sister and my mother. Now, they may not have my physical DNA, but they got my spiritual DNA. I mean, the last common relative I might be able to find with somebody is Noah. We don't look the same or anything. We certainly aren't close blood relatives in that sense. But if they're spiritual connection, whoever does the will of God, that's my brother, that's my sister, that's my mother, that's my blood relative, spiritual blood relative. Matthew 7. Verse 21. Matthew 7, verse 21. Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, shall enter the kingdom of heaven, but he who does the will of my Father in heaven. Now that's who you and I want to enter into alliances with, close relationships with, be bound together with, that kind of person, whether or not they're a blood relative. Oftentimes they won't be. But those who do the will of my Father in heaven, that's who's going to be in the kingdom of God. That's who we want to be in alliance with and on the same side of. And then the fourth timeless truth that we'll see played out in this individual's life next week. No individual will succeed with God. I hope there's not a period there, don't you? No individual will succeed with God. There's a comma there, not a period. That's not the final lesson. No individual will succeed with God and in God's judgment. Not ultimately. No individual will succeed with God and God's judgment. Not ultimately. Because of someone else's righteousness. No individual will succeed with God and in God's judgment, not ultimately, because of someone else's righteousness or someone else's faith, someone else's relationship with God. That's not how it works. We can encourage one another, but there's no coattails. There's no coattails into the kingdom of God. I can't get there on your righteousness and faith. You can't get there on mine. There's no coattails. No individual will succeed with God in God's judgment, not ultimately, because of someone else's righteousness or faith or relationship with God. Each individual must stand before God on his own convictions, his own character, his own faith. Each individual must stand before God based on his own convictions, his own character, his own decisions, his own faith, not anybody else's. This is a timeless truth for all people at all times. No individual will succeed with God and in God's judgment, not ultimately, because of someone else's righteousness or convictions or faith or relationship with God. In the final analysis, each individual must stand before God based on his own convictions, his own character, his own decisions, his own faith, nobody else's. Romans 14. And we'll see that very clearly next week in this one person's life story. Romans 14, verse 10. Romans 14 and verse 10. Why do you judge your brother? Why do you show contempt for your brother? We shall all stand before the judgment seat of Christ. It is written, as I live, says the Eternal, every knee, every individual knee. That person kneels before God doesn't do me any good. My knee has to kneel before. Every knee shall bow to me. Every tongue shall confess to God. So then each of us, each one of us, shall give account of himself to God. That's a timeless principle. No coattails. Now we lock arms. We encourage each other. We support each other. That's one of the great benefits of Sabbath and Sabbath services and attending, fellowshipping. That goes a long way, but it doesn't go ultimately. No coattails. Galatians 6, verse 4. This is so clearly stated here. Galatians 6 and verse 4. Let each individual, examine his own work, and then he will have rejoicing in himself alone. This is before God in judgment. Not in another. Each one shall bear his own load. Let him who is... Well, I guess that's all I want to read there. Each one. Verse 7. Don't be deceived. God is not mocked. Whatever a man sows, that he will reap. It's not that person sows and you reap, or you sow and they reap. I sow, I reap. He sows, he reaps. God is not mocked. Whatever a man sows, that he will reap. For he who sows to his flesh will of the flesh reap corruption, but he who sows to the Spirit will of the Spirit reap everlasting life. So that guy over there sows spiritual seed and harvests spiritual benefits. That doesn't do me any good. Indirectly, maybe by looking at his good example. But I got to sow my own spiritual seed and reap my own spiritual harvest, and so does everybody. 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 10. We must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, that each one may receive the things done in the body, according to what he has done, not what somebody else has done, whether good or bad. And then finally on this point, 1 Corinthians chapter 3. So this is well proven by the Scriptures, this point. No individual will succeed with God in God's judgment, ultimately, because of someone else's righteousness or convictions. In the final analysis, ultimately, each individual must stand before God based on his own personal convictions, faith, and character, and decisions. 1 Corinthians chapter 3. Verse 8. Now he who plants and he who waters are one, and each one will receive his own reward according to his own labor. Now that's the reward, true, but even being in the kingdom of God. I guess the only adjustment I would say to what I've said, the only other person's righteousness who will ultimately do you any good is Christ. Christ living in you. But no other human being will that be the difference maker. Nobody else's faith will do you any good or me any good except Christ. Christ's faith in us. We'll modify it to that extent. All right, those are four principles. Even in horrible, frightening, evil, and chaotic, and ungodly times, there will be largely unknown some silent heroes in the shadows who serve the true God. There's always more than one left. Come out of her, my people. Unholy alliances between good and evil do not work in the long run. They do not please God. Even though blood is thicker than water, it's not a very good basis. It's not the ultimate basis for making important decisions in life. Who am I related to? No individual will succeed with God in God's judgment ultimately based on anybody else's character. We will leave it there for today and hopefully be able to pick it up and look at specific cases, a specific case next time.